coming year, you will help the Son in its northward journey to be supported so that each day of the month, as it moves toward the winter solstice, each one of us will have a little more contribution to make. We will not be satisfied simply to take sun baths or take a vacation in a present climate. We will not be happy to allow the sun simply to shine on us while we do nothing. We will rather realize that our purpose is to have the sun shine not on us, but through us, to all that is necessary, to all that is vital, to all that is valuable to the common good. So to grow up each year with the sun is very important, so that each year we become a little wiser, a little happier, and a little stronger, and more inclined to offer thanks and our various offerings to the sovereign sun. And then when we come finally to the summer solstice, and it begins to fade again, then we suddenly have another descriptive thought. As the sun slowly fades into the winter, it leaves us standing on our own feet. As it grows less day by day, we must supplement this loss through our own insights. If it is possible to recognize that in winter, people who are poverty-stricken need help in the form of clothing and food because the seasons are too inclement, in the same way, the soul, functioning in its own needs, requires a little more of our giving when the great sovereignty of the sun fades a little from us. It is as though we were growing into maturity, and little by little the parents who guided us fade away. And as they become less and less capable of guiding and guarding, then we must take over ourselves, take care of our own destinies, and guard and guide those who have loved us. Everything is a sharing, and every year is an opportunity to grow enough to share a little more, to do something better about all these things, rather than to simply drift along from day to day in our old ways. It seems, therefore, that somewhere along the way, we're going to have to get a new theology, in a sense, based upon the interpretation of the vast theology of existence itself. We have created all kinds of religions. Some are good, some are not quite so good. All are mostly sincere, there's no question about it. But there's something that they sort of set them apart. Theology was a branch of learning to be listed with medicine or art or literature or law. Theology was a separate thing to build a separate doctrine or a separate integrity to guide people through the years of life. There was nothing essentially wrong with it. The difficulty with it was it gradually crystallized. It gradually came into a state in which the acceptance of the theology was what helped. And this is not true. It is the living of it. It is the exploring of it. It is the divine examination of all these different values. And the real purpose of theology is to form a ladder up which man can step rung by rung until he can come face to face with reality itself. So in the course of time, this theological structure has lost its vitality. It has lost the realization that it was a science of salvation, not merely a series of beliefs. And that when two or more religions lock in some kind of horrible animosity, each one claiming to be more kindly than the other and committing every conceivable crime in the name of the God of love, if this type of thing happens, gradually little people, ordinary folks, are going to begin to see through the situation. They're going to realize more and more that these great formal structures are crystallized into patterns. Some of these patterns are good. There's no reason why we shouldn't follow the faith of our fathers if we're so inclined. But we should take that faith as a means of discovering the faith of our one Father, the eternal light from which we come. We must keep faith with truth and life not merely with an assortment of opinions and beliefs. We must take no shortcuts. We must not try to join something that will save us from our miseries without improving our natures. Everything must be done lawfully and properly. Man is rewarded for his works and not for his promises. He is rewarded for his deeds and not for his pretensions. Each person in his own way is a traveler toward the light. And that light cannot be taken from him. It cannot be obscured by any physical phenomena. It could not even be destroyed or obscured if the planet Earth itself dissolved, because this light is eternal. And that which becomes one with it gains eternity with it. That which comes to see it shares it. And little by little, the individual who saw only his own backyard gradually begins to see his neighbor's life, and then his country's life, then the world life. Everything comes as the person gains through the experiences of the testing of beliefs with love and understanding. One of the problems that we have had is the importance of travel. People who have seen other faiths have a better understanding than those who have been locked always in their own. The more we experience or see or behold or appreciate the dedications, the convictions, the ideals of other people, other nations and other races, the more we suddenly come to realize that all these faiths are one faith, separated only by geography and language. The real facts are always the same, and the facts are the oneness of life, the parenthood of the divine, and the brotherhood of humanity. These are the great truths. These are the things that we should think about a little bit as we come to the Christmas season. For we are about to be given a new opportunity to grow. The gates of the temple will open again, and the processions of the initiates will enter in to experience more testing, more trials, more proofs of integrity. And as their proofs improve, as they show themselves to be more and more worthy, the secrets of the eternal will flow through them. The more we become enlightened and awake inwardly, the more we will understand of the universe. The more the great truths of life will shine through to strengthen us and create in us a positive dedication. There are some interesting patterns and things that have come down to us from the ancients, including these various rituals, most of which tell us definitely that all ritualism is merely a symbol of life process. Rituals are things that life passes through in the process of becoming and later in the process of bestowing. These two great processes work together. The child born into the world, even in infancy, is passing through initiations. The initiation of learning to walk, the initiation of learning to cry, the initiation of depending upon the love of parent and bestowing from itself a strange trustfulness which has not been destroyed by sophistication or abuse. The child's perfect acceptance of life reminds us of primitive society that in the beginning did not have the type of mind that censored, divided, was suspicious. And because it was not suspicious, there were no suspicions. The whole thing developed within that child itself. Then came the second initiation into the mysteries, and that was growth. Here we find the child faced by the gradual dawning of its own vital resources. Here we find the child going to school, facing education, facing the various dangers and hazards of gradual acceptance into physical society. Here the child passes through so-called childhood diseases, and most people have them philosophically and religiously also. Strange diseases of uncertainty, disappointment, disillusionment, discouragement, and antagonism of religious conflicts. These things the child has to learn while it is going to grammar school and taking long lessons and material it'll never use because it has no vital significance. But the child has to learn this. But then it goes into the next cycle, and having not learned anything too important, it has not been given even the enlightenment that we associate with the Montessori method of training children. Instead of having that child going into its teens with a little firm understanding of basic values, it enters into its emotional adolescence, which is the most dangerous period of its life, with practically no mature help. Here it has to learn. Here it has to pass through all kinds of experiences, some of them very trying, which can gradually become tragic, as we find with young people of today, who have to enter this period without any help, with very little understanding and very little preparation. The only thing they can gradually do is learn from experience. They have to go through things until finally, through experience, through constant repetition of error, they come to the realization of what is right and what is good. So they finally pass through this period of life, hoping, struggling, trying to make those adjustments which are necessary to the establishment of home and family. And then they come to the next period. And this is the period which the ancients associated with the sovereign sun itself, career. Here the person has to build his way of life, prepare the problems of survival, employment, profession, also all of the maturities of mind and emotions which are necessary to the maintenance of a proper civilization or a proper integrity of life. Here we find the child now grown up in what might be termed the golden age, ruled by the sun itself. For here is strength, here is courage, here is the long period of career that extends between the end of education and retirement. This is the period in which the world must be faced. And in this facing, it is very important that the growing person shall begin to understand the mistakes that society itself has established. That we are all in a society that is not in harmony with universal truth, universal order, or divine love. We are in a strange kind of twilight which we have created for ourselves through the constant emphasis upon selfishness. Here we have the fortune hunter, the accumulator, the wealth and fame seeker, all of which, we may say, constitute a general failure as far as the initiation rites are concerned. No one can have enough money to buy entrance to the temple. He must do it, he must make this entrance, not by what he has, but by what he is. And if in so doing he has made the choice to depend upon accumulation for survival, he has made a mistake that will have to be paid for sometimes by many years of misfortune. All the way along, however, the planetary cycle is moving him through the degrees of a mystery initiation, a ritual of maturing. After he gets to this period of having attained worldliness in all its many aspects, and along the way undoubtedly accumulating a large number of disappointments, a great deal of sorrow, and terribly disillusioning events, he passes then into the next great cycle. And he passes into the cycle, you might say, of the elder statesman. He now becomes the counselor of others. He now becomes the authority on one thing or another. But most of all, he is presumed to become an authority on the management of his own life. At this stage, the children have grown up. The responsibilities that he had are gradually becoming less, and there is a constantly unfolding realization that there is something more important than this little life that he has been satisfied to waste or use in one way or another. So here comes a little bit of judgment, a little bit of thought, a little search for wisdom, a turning back to religion after a life of materialism. And there is society doing the same thing as it is today, turning back to religion after a great outburst of scientific materialism. Little by little, the mind matures as much as it can. It benefits to whatever measure it can benefit from the experiences of life. But along the way, it has failed largely to accumulate the various details of procedure which would have made it easier. There has been no definite study, no definite consideration until the emergency arose. I remember an emergency of this kind that came to my attention many years ago. A young man in his early 40s, with a beautiful family, all the physical needs of life, a workable profession that was honorable and sufficient, dying. I was with him when he passed. He was a complete materialist. So he said, before he went, so we had a little talk, and when we finished the talk, he died. But he said, why have I no faith? I need faith, but I haven't got it. I don't know what to do. I don't know why I exist. I don't know where I'm going. I'm leaving everything that's dear and near to me. I want to see my children grow up. I want to see my wife happy, but now it's all taken away. There's nothing, and I don't know why. Now, for a man to graduate from a great university, have a successful business and a happy home, and be unable to answer any of those questions is an indictment of our society. It is something that is almost incomprehensible that a person can be called educated and be profoundly ignorant about all the personal values of life. How can a person who knows, as we all know, that we must leave this world, make no preparation for the journey? So before he passed, I said maybe the last words of Socrates would be of some consolation to you. Socrates, after he drank the hemlock, turned for his last words with his disciples. And he said, "Don't weep for me. Don't mourn me. Don't be sorry for me. Be rather sorry for those who stay behind." But this, I tell you, of all my life, I've looked for the answers. I want to know more. I want to understand better. I want to see more clearly. And in a few minutes, I'm going to leave here. And there's only one of two things that can happen. Either I will go to sleep and never wake again, and there will be no Socrates, and no vestige of him, or no end product of him. He will cease completely and entirely. If that is the case, I have no further worry, for I will not exist to worry at all. The other possibility is that when I go forth, I'm not going to cease. Rather, I am going to come into the presence of many mysteries that I cannot solve in this life. If I do not perish, then I will know I am immortal. If I have a survival and a part of a universe of unknown and invisible principles after death, probably I will understand some of them. Therefore, I will either cease or I will go forth to know the answers to the questions I have sought all my life in this world. Well, I told the young man that, and he kind of held my hand for a minute. He says, "I think I understand." And he went. So this is the type of problem that we should think about perhaps at this season of the year. We should think about the creation of a way of life, which is a dedication of the Christian spirit. We are told clearly that the gift of life is the gift of God. We are told clearly that love took flesh and dwelt among us for the redemption of all that lived. These things are parts of faith that sometimes are closer to children than they are to the adult. But in any event, we are celebrating today the annual birthday of the Divine Son, whether it is spelt with an S-U-N or an S-O-N. It becomes the symbol of infinite life, infinite light, and infinite love. Therefore, this is a very important day. It's not much use for us to go out and make resolutions, because we'll break them in a few days. But we can begin to understand, not placing a penalty upon ourselves, but allowing the self within us to grow a little, to begin to open up, simply because our thoughts are more generous and more kindly, and that we are beginning to realize that happiness is not something we can gain by direct effort. Happiness is a byproduct. It comes as the result of doing things right, living and thinking and loving and hoping in harmony with the divine purpose of things. We live in a universe that is completely lawful. And that law is not only a code of conduct, it is the security of an infinite love. Law is a discipline given to the universe that it may fulfill its proper destiny. And it is the same with us. The disciplines of living are the ways that we gain eternal life. So at this time, we should perhaps be a little more thoughtful, a little more considerate of these great values, that we should realize that the return of the Sovereign Son is a new invitation to growth. Just as the little seeds will come out of the earth again, and the birds will sing again, so all life will take on the glories of the spring and summer. And these glories in our hearts are not fulfilled simply on the physical plane of natural harvests and so forth. In our lives, these promises of eternal progress, this new opportunity to grow, is the greatest gift that anything can give. This is nothing that can be put in a stocking that will do for us that which a thought of constructive integrities can do for us. It can help us to bridge difficulties and intervals. And the sharing of our convictions with each other, because we really want to share, is an enrichment for all concerned. Today we are searching for world peace. And in the first day of January, we will have another opportunity, a year for the searchings out of the ways of peace. The beginning, even today, before Christmas, we are beginning at this instant a new opportunity to preserve all the values that are necessary to the survival of our personal lives and the nation to which we belong. It is all a matter of consecrations, a matter of not being consecrated to some code of our own. That has been our trouble. We have built little mountains of our own convictions. We have decided in our own way, with very arbitrary purposes, what we're going to do and how we're going to think and what's going to happen. This is not it. This is the opportunity that we have to allow ourselves to experience the will of life itself. Experience the purpose for which we are intended, and not the purposes that we try to create for ourselves. Every one of us is part of an eternal atom. Every one of us is in some way related to everything else that exists. We are all one great, wonderful being under one eternal power. If we can begin to think about this, see it, and understand it, then maybe we can start a year in which each of us will be more mindful of the good of others and not live completely and entirely for the accomplishment of personal ends. There is the personal which will go down to the darkness with us. there is an impersonal which will rise phoenix-like into the light of a better and more noble existence. Not only are we thinking now of our own present time, but the future that lies ahead. We came into this world with uncertain destinies because of our own natures. We brought with us a load of unfinished business, most of which, unfortunately, was not entirely happy. We come here to pay our debts, but also to receive our rewards. There is no such a thing as nothing but punishment. Somewhere along the line, we did something right in the past, therefore something good happens now. But there is inconsistency, uncertainty in our way of life. It is therefore very important for us to begin to live better now, because we have to live with ourselves as long as individuality remains, which is quite a time yet. So we have to be true to ourselves now to be able to live with ourselves later. And the more that we build into our consciousness of that which is right and true and beautiful and useful, the better the future will be. So on Christmas today, and the Christmas day, the little man with the red coat and the white whiskers comes to a kind of happy reminder. Perhaps this little man with the red suit and the white whiskers is also an extended symbol of the sun that is going to bring us another year of joys. It's going to come from the North Pole, which is pretty good astronomy at that. Very much. For in the old systems, the wheel of the zodiac was placed with Capricorn at the midheaven and Cancer at the nadir. Therefore, the little man that comes from the far north can be a symbol of the earth deity of the ancient Egyptians, a little rotund creature that brought the toys to children, because the Egyptians also celebrated Christmas, and they did it as we did, with little stone dolls and little toys and gifts and little presents of clothing and jewelry and things. But this also came from the great north, the symbol of the unknown, the inclination of the plumed helmet of Osiris was the inclination of the earth's axis, exactly as we know it today. So from the north comes the light, the north being in this case the birthplace of the annual sun. So in Capricorn, the sun is reborn. It is reborn to shine down over the coming months until finally it reaches the fullness of its summer. Then it begins to retire because it has left behind all that is necessary for the next step in human life, and that is man taking care of himself. Now, how does he do this? A farmer can tell you. When the seasons are right, he plants his grain. When the grain is ripe, he puts the seed away for the next harvest. Then he takes and stores away the food for the winter. Every prudent person is storing something for the winter, because he does not wish to consider that he has been improvident. So the individual who stores up his own integrities, who has lived a little better during the year, who has done a little good to others, has put away something for the winter. So that as the light of the common sun is dimmed, the light in our own hearts grows brighter, and we can definitely see and experience the inner light. This the Egyptians also believed. For they believed that when Horus was not visible in the great ship of the sun, he was still there. And the Peleus in his Metamorphosis, the great story of his initiation rite, as translated by Taylor and several others now, the candidate in the mysteries sees the sun shining underneath his feet. This is a peculiar statement connected with the initiation rites. But because he has been taken in darkness from the outside world to the darkness of the inner world, but he sees even in the darkness of the inner world that the light is shining beneath his feet. That is, the light is shining from the earth when it is not shining from the heavens. And therefore it is shining from man when it is not shining from nature. And man becomes the sun and becomes the sovereign sun himself, and by his own light brings nourishment, life, hope, happiness, growth, security to his own kind. In winter, the individual has his chance to do things. Instead of being required to wait or to hope, or just simply through laziness to consider that he will be taken care of, he comes to a season when he must take care of himself. And the world today is in that season, a season in which we can no longer depend upon the errors of others, or no longer depend upon the corruptions of codes. The light has become a little dim for us now. We are in a winter of our discontent. And in this particular season, the sun, psychologically, is obscured. The sun has gone its eternal way. And we must take over the holding of the light until the next winter solstice. The period from the summer solstice to the winter solstice becomes our responsibility. It is harvesting and conserving and preserving, and the process is represented by the constellation of Virgo with a sheaf of grain, which is the symbol of putting the harvest away. In the spring, heaven bestows. In the fall, man conserves. Little by little, the whole astronomical universe breaks down into a morality. A morality that has the most perfect evidence that we can have. The only evidence, really. Everything else is conjecture, except that the sun rises, and that also that spring comes. All things that are immovable and eternal and inevitable have to become the basis of the building of a useful philosophy of life. If we do not build upon that kind of a foundation, we are in serious trouble. So I'd like to think of the term, as the sun moves northward, that we will all move with it to become parts, cooperative parts, so that out of our own hearts, rays of that sun will shine upon a world that is beginning to awaken from the sleep of materiality and to come again into the light of the love of God. Thank you very much.